And welcome to Today with a Techie, TWA Tech Radio. I am Stank Dog, and we're going to be going through actually a presentation that I had put together for a group of programmers and technical people on the topic of PL SQL tips and tricks. Now, I'm going to give a little bit of an introduction here to what PL SQL is, because this was very much given to a target audience of people who knew what we were talking about. But for those of you who don't know what we're talking about here, I'll bring everybody up to speed and first talk about Oracle Relational Database Management System. Oracle is probably a name everybody listening to this has heard of before, but it is basically a relational database management system along the lines of SQL Server, MySQL, Postgres, lots of others out there. They all do a similar thing, and that is help you manage your data. Well, that's all well and good, but don't you want to be able to have some kind of control or way to interact with your data? You can't just throw it into a database and point and click your way through it, unless, of course, you're using Microsoft SQL Server, but that's a whole other topic. You need to be able to get in there and actually manipulate and modify and update and change, delete, etc., your data. And to do that in any database, there is a language called SQL. And each one of these different databases has their own flavor of SQL. There is an SQL standard, an ANSI SQL standard that exists and everybody obeys for the most part, but they also add on their own, nuances and peculiarities with each one of the database engines. So, as I said, we're going to be talking about Oracle specifically with this presentation, which is what I program in pretty much on a daily basis. And Oracle's brand of SQL is actually called PLSQL. So we're going to start this presentation, and I'm going to kind of ease our way into this. Just keep in mind that these are going to be pretty detailed. Might be tough to deliver over the radio, but we're going to give it a shot. So, as I said, we are going to be talking about PLSQL tips and tricks. So we're going to go into a little bit of detail. We're going to start off, though, with some definitions. Now, as I said a few minutes ago, SQL, which stands for, of course, Structured Query Language, has been around since the 70s, and it is a language that will allow you to issue short commands, one-time queries, hard-coded scripts that you're going to use one time that basically run sequentially start to finish. So Structured Query Language or Sequential Query Language, I've heard both used before. And there are a couple of different statements or a couple of different types of statements in SQL. First statement is called DML, or Data Manipulation Language, and this is definitely the most common. Anybody out there who has done any kind of interacting with databases has probably seen these. These are, well, it's pretty self-descriptive, data manipulation language, anything that's going to manipulate your data. That being select your data, insert, update, delete statements, things like that, where you're actually interacting directly with your data. Now, these are very, very common, and you've probably seen them somewhere before if you haven't actually written anything from scratch yourself. And when people say SQL, that's commonly what they're referring to, and they are pretty universal. As I said, there are standards that have been around for a long time, and select is pretty much going to work on every single database that you can ever find. Insert is going to work. There might be a couple tiny nuances to each one, but for the most part, they're going to be identical using the DML part of the language. Now, there's another part of the language called DDL. This is Data Definition Language. Data Definition Language is the object manipulation part of the language. And if you only deal with selects and updates, and you've never dealt with any kind of data definition language, you're not really using the full potential of the database. Most database engines these days are completely object-oriented. You've got different types of objects out there that you define as what type they are, and any kind of manipulation you want to do with them is done with the DDL statements of SQL. And these are statements like create, alter, or drop. And there's many more, obviously, we could go into more, but creating new things such as create a new table, create a stored procedure, things like that. So these are DDL statements, and they're another part of SQL. And there is a third part that's even less common, because you'll only run into these when you're working on developing and creating programs, working on data and having to do and undo data. And these are called TC, or transaction control part of the language. This is when you're actually changing the state of the data, for lack of a better word. When you're connecting to a relational database management system, and this is pretty universal as well, but again, we're speaking specifically of Oracle here. you are going to be operating in a controlled environment that only you see and only you are having access to. So what it's doing is it's taking a snapshot, for lack of a better word, of the state of all of the data in the database. So if someone else is manipulating data on the other side, and you're manipulating data on your side, any changes that the person on the other end makes are not going to be seen by you and vice versa until you go out of your way to actually commit those changes and say, yes, I want all of the database to be updated. If you don't go out of your way to do that, you're working in just kind of a temporary session so that you can manipulate your data, you can undo things, you can work in it and do your programming until you're certain that you're actually ready to move this out for everybody to see. So these type of things are handled by the transaction control parts of the language where you're changing the states of the data. And these are session control statements, system control statements, but again, they're more common to programmers. Now, a couple of tricks and kind of traps, if you will, in here that I'm gonna insert as we go through this presentation is as we go along, and one of them right here that I should bring up. A lot of people don't realize that when you issue a DDL statement, that would be that second one we talked about, the create alter. As soon as you issue a DDL statement, you actually force commit your data. So if you're doing a bunch of updates, inserts, deletes, that kind of thing, and you think that you're safe because you're working only in your area and you haven't gone out of your way to intentionally commit that data, the second you issue any DDL statement, you actually will do a force commit of any changes. So if you do a delete of every record out there and you think to yourself, oh, that's okay, it hasn't applied to anything, I'll just log off and everything will be fine. But then later on you enter any type of DDL, whether it's a alter table, create a new program, compile a new program of some kind, when it does that, it's going to do a force commit up front. And that's because the database management system is actually trying to be smart and make, I guess for lack of a better word, a rollback point before it does its compile, thinking that you might want to go back there. But the act of doing that actually commits any changes that you may have done beforehand. So be careful with your DDL statements, because they are going to submit anything. And frankly, when you're doing your data manipulation language of any kind, you should always be careful to stop and immediately and explicitly roll back any changes that you've done, just in case, unless you're absolutely positive that you want those to be applied to the entire database. You should always get in the habit of rolling things back as soon as you're done looking at your data. Let's see what else. I think that was a good explanation of that, I hope. And again, these were designed to interact with databases many, many years ago, but they're only designed for straightforward needs. When you're going to actually say, select this data from this table so that you can look at it on the screen, so that you can deliver it to a report, output one time, something like that. But what are you going to do when you have needs that are a lot more complex? Plain old SQL, sequential query language, or structured query language, is not powerful enough to write programs as any programmer or anyone who's taught programming these days would understand. There's no sort of program control in these. All you're doing is running things sequentially. And that is where PLSQL comes in the case of Oracle. And PLSQL stands for Procedural Language SQL, which is Oracle's flavor. And procedural language has become a fairly common or generic phrase these days. You can call Microsoft SQL Server or any of the other databases. You can usually refer to those as a procedural language SQL SQL as well, but they might call it something different. For example, Microsoft SQL Server uses what they call TSQL. It is a procedural language, but it's called TSQL or Transact SQL. In Oracle, the equivalent is called PLSQL. In Postgres, it's PGPLSQL, Postgres Procedural Language SQL. Anyway, PLSQL allows you to use structured programming techniques like looping. Now, anybody who's done any program knows that you can't just run a program and have it pass sequentially start to finish. This isn't quick basic days where we're going back and running 10, 20, 30, 40. And frankly, even quick basic or even old basic, you had go-to statements in there. So that, what I would argue, is a form of looping that we don't really need these days with new structured programming languages. However, I digress. Now, PLSQL gives you programming techniques like looping so that you can do for loops, you can do if-then, nested logic checks and things like that, and allows you to write an actual quote-unquote program. Now, program is not exactly a word that you use frequently in the Oracle world. You can, but program is kind of a generic term. Most things that you refer to as a program in Oracle are actually stored as database objects, and most commonly they are stored procedures, what they're called. And that's the Oracle, or the database object type, as a stored procedure of what we mostly think of as programs. There are other types. There is something called a function. You can create or replace a function, which is very much a program and very much uses the same PLSQL techniques that you would use when you write a stored procedure. They're just different applications of them. So we really probably shouldn't go down too much down that path, because that could become a whole presentation in and of itself, and we're talking about a lesson in how to write PLSQL programming in Oracle, which may be something for an upcoming show. But all of these things, as we kind of referred to earlier, are stored objects in the database. So most of your programming is going to be in this form, and they're going to be created as database objects using those DDL statements. DDL create statements that we talked about earlier. Create, or there's a replace statement. So the first time that you compile it is create, and then if you ever make any changes, you will replace that stored procedure. And of course, Oracle realizes, and everybody thinking right now probably says, well, wait a minute, you do sometimes while you're developing, you're going to be updating that all the time. So what's commonly done is you will use a create or replace. So you can use the or reserved word. If it create or replace, so if it's there for the first time, it's creating it. Otherwise, it is updating it all the time. And PLSQL can be used to write reports, interfaces, which is interface would be some sort of interaction to like a bank, or some sort of processing company, any kind of external, anything external to your database, an interface. It could be any kind of format that you could think of. Could be a CSV file, could be an XML file. That, of course, is all in your control of what you need, but you can write those PLSQL programs to do that, to do file extracts of any kind. And the rest of this talk, we're going to concentrate specifically on PLSQL, talk about some of the common functions and procedures that come with Oracle PLSQL. So we're going to really get into some detailed stuff here, and I hope it's going to translate well over the radio. Now, we just talked about stored procedures and functions, so we're going to kind of compare and contrast them just a little bit, and hope this makes some sense. I'm going to try my best here. There's two different object types that you're going to use the most: functions and stored procedures. Again, I said earlier, stored procedures are what you're going to use most often, but these are most common, and they're commonly called programs, although they're technically they're database object, just like functions or tables, so just another object type. Functions are really, really handy, however. Functions are, again, a type of program called a function, not a stored procedure, a function. And a function is very interesting because really, if you get right down to it, a lot of the functionality, if you will, a lot of the things that you learn as part of PLSQL are actually functions that are built on top of basic SQL statements. So a lot of things that we kind of think of are, and I guess it would help to have some Oracle experience here, but a lot of things you might think of, conversion functions, date conversion functions, things like this, these aren't really statements that are supported by the language. These are actually pre-written functions that Oracle ships with its database that you can use, kind of a black box. It's kind of an object type that, if you wanted to compare it to, say, .NET, comes with a bunch of pre-written functions, a bunch of pre-written routines that would allow you to do certain things by simply calling them and passing the proper parameters. Well, Oracle does the same thing, and it will ship with a lot of functions that will allow you to simply pass the right parameters into this sort of black box. Actually, it's really a white box. You can look at the code for all of this stuff very easily. It's not hidden. And this actually adds on to the language. The language can actually build and grow. And the other great thing is that's fine that Oracle ships a bunch of these with their database, but just as easily, the way the system handles and runs functions, you can just as easily write a function of your own that will operate and work just the same as any of the ones that ship with Oracle. So if you do find something that Oracle does not have, or do find something that you want to use, or you need to just pass some data into it and get a result out of it and not have to write and have long programs. You can write a separate function to do that. So one of the things you should do when you write a function is, and this is true of any type of programming, is try to make your code reusable. Make it as universal as possible and never hard code any values. If you need to, you can even pass an extra parameter that helps the program decide what to do instead of hard coding a value or a data type inside of it. So these can be called. The other great thing about functions is they can be called from almost anywhere, just like a field name. So there's a function, for example, with Oracle called upper, U-P-P-E-R. And all that function does is it'll convert whatever field name you tell it, say last name, upper parentheses last name, end parentheses, will convert that field, the value of that field, to all uppercase characters. So it's very simple, straightforward. That's one that comes with Oracle. There's also one called initcap that if you pass it a field name, it will change the first character of each word in that field to a capital letter, to the equivalent capital letter. So these are a lot of things that are very common, a lot of people use, so they come with it. But if for some reason you wanted to convert the third character in a string field to uppercase, you might want to write your own function to do that. Why? I don't know. I'm making up an example to illustrate. But let's say you wanted to convert the third character of a function of a field, and you had to write your own function to do that. You could write your own function and pass into it not only the field name, but the second thing might be the position of the character that you want to write an send an uppercase to. So somebody could write a function called any upper, or upper 2, we'll call it, upper 2, parentheses, the field name, comma, and position 3 to convert that third character to uppercase, or initcap, or whatever you wanted to call it. So what I'm trying to illustrate here is that you can write your own functions to do whatever you want. And when you do so, you should write it in such a way, you could easily hard code 3 into the logic, just pass upper 2 a field name and say always convert the third one. But try to be as smart and as universal as possible, add an extra parameter in there of which one you want to upgrade, because it might not always be the third one. If somebody later on says, oh, I need a function that will convert the fifth character to uppercase for whatever reason, your program, if you had hard coded it with a 3 in the logic, would not work. However, if you pass a parameter to it for that position, it will be more universal, and you can just give them the code and say, here it is, just pass a 5 to it, and it'll work that much easier. So again, this is something that's universal. It's especially great for writing functions, but you know, Henry David Thoreau said, simplify, simplify, and you should always do that. You should try to keep everything in there as universal as possible, as straightforward as possible, and write your function so that it's short and does a specific thing. Don't try to write a lot of logic in your functions. That's where your storage procedure is. Your storage procedure is going to have most of your logic in it, and you're only going to write or use functions to do something on the fly. And you can do those even in your select clauses, just like a field name was. You could select last name from table, or you could select upper of last name from the table, or use the one we just created a second ago in our example, select upper 2 last name, comma, fifth character, 5, from table. All of those will work. You can plug them right in, and that's something that's unique to functions. On a procedure, you can't really do that the same way. So again, Oracle ships with numerous functions that are stored in system libraries, and the way that they work is not much different than the ones that you would write yourself. So if it's not already out there, or you could probably go find it on the global interweb somewhere if you wanted to go out there and search as well. But if not, you could write it yourself. And the other thing about functions is that functions should only be used to return one value. Technically, you can return multiple values with a function. But until you're really advanced and really know what you're doing with that, I would highly recommend you don't do it. And when I say returning a value, I mean an object type of some kind. For example, you're passing in that last name and the position. You're going to return a string. You're going to return a value, one field, back. You could easily return, well, not so much easily, but you could return, have it do a lot more than that. Maybe break it up into two separate fields. Maybe only return the original string and the capital letter. You could do those kind of things. You have the control and the power. It's very flexible to allow you to do that. but you should probably not get yourself into that bad habit. You should write a separate function anytime you want to return a value. It can be now an object type of table or a record with multiple fields if you wanted to. It doesn't have to just be one 20-character string for a last name. You could easily make it an entire two-dimensional table and return that if you actually know the syntax on how to do it. And I have had need to do that before, but very, very, very rarely should you ever do that. And technically, you can use multiple out parameters to separate them. That is to say, Oracle will not stop you from doing it. They will allow you to do it. So technically you can, but really don't do it. Anything that's going to give you more than one return value should be a whole separate stored procedure or multiple functions. So functions, but there are also stored procedures. And again, stored procedures are what you're going to use most often. These are, if you ever do say program, which again is not a common term in Oracle programming, believe it or not, most people just say, write a stored procedure, I need a stored procedure, I wrote a stored procedure. But these are what a lot of people might think of as a program. When you sit down to write something, you're going to write a stored procedure first. And technically, they're a database object just like functions or tables. I think I mentioned that earlier. Now, along these topics, when you're creating these objects or whatever, then you also have to think about naming conventions. Again, this is a universal programming practice, universal advice that you can apply to any language. Specifically for Oracle and PLSQL, you should, what I prefer to do, and of course everybody's going to be a little bit different. Use any kind of internal reporting if you're developing in-house programs and stuff like that. Just come up with whatever naming convention is going to work for your situation. Some things are universal, like for example, I like to start all my function names with F underscore. Anytime I see something that's F underscore object type, I know that it's a function. I know how functions work. I just described them a minute ago. I know that I can pass a parameter and get one value back out of it in most cases. Or if I'm writing a stored procedure, I'll use a P underscore and I'll recognize that immediately as a stored procedure. So that's great. Just whatever you choose, be consistent with it. But not only with the object names or the program names and things like that, but your variable naming conventions are important as well. What I like to do is I use a G underscore for any kind of global variable, L underscore for a local variable, something that's contained within one stored procedure or within one function. And a third one is parm underscore, P-A-R-M, which I use for parameters. So if I am passing something into a function, I will pass it as whatever the variable name is that I'm passing. But in the actual function itself, what it's being brought in as is parm underscore last name. And then as I work through my logic, I know that the one that says parm underscore last name and the one that's L underscore last name is local. They're not the same one, and it helps kind of keep things clear in my head when I'm writing programs, and should for just about anybody, I would think. If you start writing things without naming conventions or with just arbitrary ones, then you're going to find yourself going back and finding or doing a control F or looking earlier in your program to see, wait a minute, did I use the right field name? What did I call this field name? Or even worse, and this is really probably the worst case scenario, is you might think you've got the right name and use completely the wrong variable name, the wrong value, the wrong field, and everything. But because it is a real variable name that you did use, it's going to compile, it's going to work, but you may be completely destroying your data in the process. It works, it compiles because the field is correct, but you're using the wrong data or referring to the wrong data. So it's very, very important that you, A, remain very consistent with your naming conventions. If you get to the point where you know that it begins with parm underscore, you know it's going to be around in the parameter section of the program, making it A, easier to find, B, more reliable to use. Now, the other thing that I like to emphasize is to be very descriptive with your names. Now, you don't have to be COBOL descriptive, which you don't have to write out these giant, long, super names. This is the variable that I am going to use to store the value for the last name. You know, let's not get crazy. We don't have to be all like that. However, you also don't have to use something like LN. LN could be a lot of different things. I mean, just because it seems last name, don't do it out of laziness. Don't do it because you just want to make your code shorter or look more, I don't know, cryptic, don't be afraid to actually be more descriptive on there. Variable names in Oracle can be up to 30 characters. Same is true for object names, procedures, functions, and triggers. They can also have up to 30 characters. So don't be afraid to call it L for local underscore last underscore name, or parm underscore last underscore name. Or maybe even, depending on your scenario, you may have something like L underscore patient underscore last name, as opposed to L underscore doctor underscore last name. So always be as descriptive as possible. Even if you try to think ahead of the whole program, try to think ahead of what might be used in the future and what might be confusing, and try to avoid putting yourself, try to make it in such a way that you may not realize, you may not think that doctor name may ever come into your database or some other type of name, but why not throw the word patient in there just in case? So later on, if you add doctor, that fits right into your naming convention. Whereas if you had L underscore last name and then all of a sudden L underscore doctor last name, that first one kind of is hung out there and still ambiguous, and you're never going to be as easy to remember as if you had clearly labeled the thing in the beginning. Now again, these are just my personal preferences. Everybody's going to be a little bit different, and I'm not going to dictate, obviously, you use whatever you're comfortable with. But really, just try to be consistent within your programs, and not only your programs. If you're working on a team, you're working on a programming team, try to have everybody on the same page. If you're a manager, try to establish, work with your programmers, try to come up with a consensus on what people are most comfortable with and what they think is most useful, and put a little, I know it sounds silly, maybe a short meeting or committee together to have everybody, get everybody in on the same page, and that way if you're swapping code around, if you're doing any kind of team coding, you're going to have to read through and debug someone else's code at any point in time, you're all on the same page. It's going to be easier to read, easier to maintain in the long run. You'll always be able to interact with each other's code, know exactly where to find things much easier and faster. Now, one thing that I really, really like about Oracle more than any other database I've worked with is the way that Oracle handles dates and times. Date functionality in Oracle, dates in any kind of database are usually very, very important. Databases track dates and times of just about everything that happens in the database because it provides sort of a built-in audit trail, first of all. But what is a date, really? I mean, think about it. What is a date? It seems like a silly question, but you got to think about it a little differently in Oracle. What a date is it's a measurement of time with a certain level of precision. Oracle stores dates internally and in a proprietary format that's accessed using a few special data types. Okay? It's a measurement of time with a certain level of precision. Now, let's kind of look at some examples in case that doesn't quite make sense. First of all, there's a data type called date, D-A-T-E, which is the most common, works in all your Oracle versions, and that format for date includes the year, the month, the day, obviously, also the hour, the minute, and the second. That's all stored in a date field. There are no fractional seconds. You're not going to have 35.56 seconds. You're only going to have hour, minute, second included into that. But date doesn't understand time zones, so a date is a date to Oracle. The user or programmer has the burden of handling time zone logic if necessary, so keep that in mind. But again, the definition I gave you earlier is a measurement of time with a certain level of precision. In this case, the date was year, month, day, hour, minute, and second precision. It does not go down to fractional seconds. Now, another data type is timestamp. It's not as common because timestamp actually didn't come out until Oracle 9i, but know that it exists if you ever need the ability or the fractional seconds or time zone calculations. Those are two things that were not added until 9i. There's, again, very rare, which is probably why they weren't added until recently, but if you ever do need to add time zone calculations or fractional seconds, unless you're like storing, you know, information about a track meet where you need those fractional seconds, just a regular date field is probably going to get the job done for you. Now, I mentioned earlier Oracle stores these in a proprietary format, but all Oracle knows about time are these big numbers that it stores internally, but we as programmers need to know that there are functions to translate that data into readable and usable information. Now, I'm going to say that again. It's worth repeating because it's going to help you in manipulating dates. It's a very common requirement that you're going to do a lot of date manipulation to look up something before or after this date or in between these dates. And keep in mind that that time stamp is in there, so you're going to have to be very careful when you work with dates. However, you have so much power and control in Oracle with dates that it's fantastic. So what are those functions that you can use? Well, one of the first ones is something called sysdate. And sysdate, S-Y-S-D-A-T-E in Oracle, is a function that returns today's date. I can do a select sysdate from anything. It doesn't even have to be a real field, because it's a function name. If I select sysdate, it's going to give me today's date with the timestamp. A date precision, as we said earlier, is going to include month, day, year, hour, minute, and second. So it's going to have all of those elements of the date type that we talked about. But that makes it kind of tricky when you're comparing this date to other dates. And that's where one of the first most useful functions come in. And that function is called trunc, T-R-U-N-C, short for truncate. Trunc is useful for comparing dates to the day when the timestamp is not important. For example, if you want to see anything that was changed on a certain day, by using trunc, you're going to completely ignore the timestamp. That's all that the trunc function does. Now, there are a lot of these out there, and we're not going to go into a lot of them. I'm just going to give you some of the common ones, like trunc, which is very useful. If you ever find yourself not getting results, if you're comparing two dates, you're trying to see, give me everything from this table where the date is equal to sysdate, today's date, and you find yourself not getting any results, and you're like thinking to yourself, I know there's data in there with today's date. What's going wrong? Well, you're comparing this date, which does not have timestamp in it, to this date, which does have timestamp. So it's comparing to see today's date versus today's date and exact time. No, you're never going to get results. That's where that trunc function comes in. You can trunc that second date, and that trunc function says chop off the timestamp. That's all it does. So now you're comparing this date from your table to a truncated version of the sysdate, which is today's date with no timestamp, and now you're going to be getting the results that you thought you were getting the first time. So be very careful with that. It's great that you have that functionality. You just have to know how to use it, and it's a very confusing thing to newcomers to Oracle, any kind of date manipulation. There are a couple other functions that go along with that as well. These are two functions called toDate, TO_DATE, and toChar, or TO_CHAR, or character, to character. And what those are date conversion fields. Dates can be just as easily stored as a string for some reason. A lot of times you'll find data coming in from external sources, or even data that you do yourself. For one reason or another, you did not decide to store it as a date format. You stored it as a string variable. That's kind of dangerous and sloppy because it leads, a string will allow you to put any character in there and doesn't enforce data integrity. So you may find people putting in some dates with forward slashes, some people putting in dates with dash, some people putting in dates with a space. Makes it a little bit trickier to do that. So it's a bad practice to ever put a date into any field other than a date type or one of the many date type fields. So why would you use toDate or toChar? Again, we said that date is just a big bunch of internal data to Oracle, but the toDate function and the toChar function, they're very similar. One's going one way, one's going the other. But what that'll do is we'll pass into the toDate function, for example, whatever the old date that you have, a string variable, let's say it's 06-21-2006. And you actually, what you need to show up on your report or what you need to compare it with is actually, say, day, then the month name, and then the last two of the year, for example. What you'll do is send the field name into your toDate function, and they have basically a masking string. And anybody who's done programming probably knows what a mask is, but basically a mask, M-A-S-K, will allow you to format the string or format the data in a certain way. The toDate function and the toChar functions, these are overloaded functions that come preloaded with tons and tons of different date formats. You simply pass in, you can pass in a huge long date with timestamp, year, month, day, and you can say, all I want you to do is pull out the year out of that entire date. So you'll pass the mask, YYYY, and it will find that year and pull that year out of that data. Very powerful that way. Or if you wanted to, again, do mm/dd/cc for century, for example, you could easily do that by simply masking it properly and running it, and it will take that data, interpret what you're asking for based on the mask, and give you the data, your date, in the exact format that you asked for. And on the same thing, you can do a 2-char. Dates can be kind of ugly. Store it as 6/21/2006 with this ugly time stamp and whatnot. And you might not want that to print off on, say, a report that you're giving to an executive. So the 2-char function very similarly works, where you'll send it the first field being the date, whatever it is. Let's use sysdate, which has all that garbage we talked about earlier. But then there are masking features in that function where you can mask that out to actually write the entire month out. You simply send the word M-O-N-T-H. M-O-N-T-H is one of the masks. And when it sees that, and then you can put a space DD, comma, YYYY. There's a lot of them. Again, we could go into a lot of details, but RTFM, when you get to that point, look up that function. You'll find all the different things that it supports. And you will take that ugly date that's stored in an internal format and convert it into a nice string that says June 21st, whatever we said, 2000. Spread it all out so it's nice and clean on your report, or if you're generating letters or things like that, make it nice and clean and readable. You ever see a letter, by the way? You ever get something in the mail where it shows, and it's obviously a computerized thing where it plugs in your last name or spam or something like that, and it's... And you get something that has the date written out, and you see the date in the format of 1/15/2007 or whatever it is. It's probably because somebody didn't know well enough what they were doing to convert that date on the fly into something a little bit nicer. So they got lazy and they just left the date as it was, thinking most people can read that. And we can, but it's just not professional. It's not as nice and easy on the eyes, if you will, than actually reading it nice and written out into a different format. So again, I kind of said this, but there's many, many more date functions and features to the ones even that I did show you. I'll make a broad statement here. I'm not afraid to say this, that I've never found any date conversion that Oracle couldn't handle. And I have done a lot of bizarre digging of information. So I have done bizarre things and requested things within certain parameters of dates that you would never think anybody would care about, but they do. So I've never found anything that Oracle could not handle as far as converting of dates. So there are some other useful functions, not directly related to dates, but kind of segue. We talked about 2Date and 2Char. Well, there's another one called 2Number, which is also kind of handy. I'd end up doing a lot of data manipulation and data pillaging from other databases, old legacy systems that did not have support for, say, did not have I guess to use an example I used earlier, they might have a date stored in a string format because they didn't know any better, or they didn't have a special date format back then, or they weren't even using a relational database management system. They were just throwing things into a text file or a CSV file or something. Well, there are some other things that come in handy. One of them is 2Number. These are all string manipulation variables we're going to talk about. A lot of people were in the bad habit back in the old days of storing everything into a string. Just throw them into a varchar or a char, varchar2, throw it in there and worry about the data later. Well, we are unfortunately having to worry about that data later. So the good thing is that Oracle comes with quite a few functions to let you manipulate that. So when I say manipulation, we're talking about string manipulation or handling of any character data, names, addresses, things like that. Well, the 2Number function, TO_number, and all you do is pass 2Number the field name that you want to change. So let's say you had like, let's say a test score. Let's say they saved your test score in character format for whatever reason. So they've got the number 75, but they stored it in a character field. Very, very, very bad programming practice. It is standard in all programming languages. Is if you've got numeric data, store it in a numeric data type. Do not be in the bad habit of throwing everything into strings. This is not 1970 something. This is 2007. You should never be storing anything in a string variable unless it is clearly a string. Sometimes I'm finding people that store two or three different values in one string field, which if you can imagine trying to parse through that and separate it can be a pain. But 2Number is a great one because you can convert that string value, as long as there is numeric data in there, convert it to a numeric data type on the fly, and either maybe update it, load it into a new field, or whatever the case may be. If it's not numeric data in there, obviously if somebody's got 7.5 in there, the next person has T5, somebody hit the wrong key or something, it's going to give you an error message because it doesn't know how to convert that. But as long as there is numeric data there, then you can convert it on the fly. And if it's not, then you probably want to let somebody know, hey, you've got bad data in this old database. So why do you want to do this? Why is it important that you convert these, and why am I emphasizing to have these in numeric format? Well, anything numeric, what if you wanted to do any kind of math on it? You can't. Let's say that 75 that you had in the string, let's say they end up putting a curve on the grade and they want to add 10 to everybody's grade. You can't really do mathematics on that string variable like that. It doesn't know how to do that. You can do it on the fly by using the toNumber function. You can convert it into working storage into a numeric type and then add 10 to that. Then you're adding two numbers together. Or any kind of math. You can add salaries together, calculate percentages on things, but unless you convert it to a number, you're not going to be able to do that. So again, ideally, you should never have numeric data stored in any character field. You won't have to worry about this. However, the reality that I've seen in my many, many years, even to this very day, a lot of data is still stored in improper formats. Now, a couple other quick ones here that come in pretty handy. There's a length function, L-E-N-G-T-H, and you pass it the field name, and it will tell you how long that field is. Very useful if you ever have custom forms of some kind where you know you've only got enough room to print the first 20 characters or the first 12 characters of a person's last name. You can go through and look at your data using the length and say, okay, let me see the length of all these people. What am I going to truncate? What is the longest record that I have or longest value I have in this particular field? So that you can know you may not have a problem. Maybe they are all less than 12 and you're fine. Maybe you find out that there's some in there that are 30 characters long. You can identify it easily with the length function and then do whatever you decide, handle that however you want to handle it. Again, string manipulation functions is what we're talking about. Another great one, and the next ones are very related. There's something called instring, or INSTR, which will look through a string for a specific character that you request. So if you wanted to, let's see, like I said earlier, a lot of people will put dates or will put things into string that have multiple values in them. One of the most common things is an address. So using the instring, I can go look through that string for a particular character or group of characters so that I can identify where maybe one value ends and another one begins. Let's say you lived on Main Street and it was stored in this field as Main Space STREET. Well, that's two different fields stored into one variable, which can be messy. Especially if it wasn't consistent. There's nothing to stop that value from being a street, and somebody else put in STR, someone else put in STR period, and so on and so on. Well, using the instring, you can go through there and look for particular things and clean them up. So I can find the string STR and realize, okay, well, that's the beginning of the second string. Give me just the first part of this, and the second part I'll put into a different variable or I'll treat it differently for whatever reason. And somewhat related to that is the substring command, substr. It's another function that will grab a certain portion of the string, whatever field or whatever character that you are interested in finding. The second thing you pass is the starting position and then the end position. So, for example, if I wanted to grab the first four characters of a name or the last four digits of a social security number, which I'm sure everybody has seen that used in a lot of different places, I could use the substring to say, okay, the field is SSN. I want you to start in position 5 or whatever, wherever you wanted to find, and however many, the length that you wanted to find. So that's a very handy function as well. Again, all of these come with Oracle. Another one I use frequently is called LTRIM or RTRIM. Or truth be told, I just use a plain old function called TRIM, T-R-I-M. But they all do the same thing. They're going to trim characters from either end of your field. A lot of times data comes in from older systems or extract files, and the people extracting them did not know how to handle the spaces that were at the end of it. These old mainframe systems, these old COBOL programs, if they say that it's a string of 30 characters and your name is Frank, Well, there's going to be 25 trailing spaces on the end of it, and that's very common. Well, the ltrim, rtrim, and trim commands are all handy to trim off spaces in whichever place you want. Left trim, right trim, or the trim will trim by itself, will trim off spaces from the front or the back of the field. So you can always trim your data down to the significant values. Take off all that stuff, because if you've got spaces in character fields, it's going to make life miserable. If I do a search for Frank and quotes F-R-A-N-K and that's it, it's not going to find that guy's value, because he's not Frank, end of string. He's Frank, space, 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 space. It's never going to find that by doing a straight comparison. So you always want to trim that down. It's just a nightmare when data has extra trailing spaces or leading spaces. Trim is what I use mostly, because you never want either one of those in most cases. However, ltrim or rtrim, in some cases, believe it or not, you may want leading blanks or trailing blanks for some specific reason. So the functionality is there. The only other thing to mention about string manipulation is that it can be especially powerful when you combine it inside of one statement. So let's say that you wanted the last four characters of, let's say you're issuing an ID number, a student ID number in a school or something like that. The length of that may vary. It starts with 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 9, and then goes to double digits, triple, quadruple, you know, it can be a 9 character. So let's say you've got 8 and 9 character lengths in there, but you wanted to find the last four characters of it. Well, because they're not always the same length, it makes it kind of tricky. You can't just count over, because some of them are longer than others. However, you can use that length function I talked about earlier to find out the length of it, and then use the substring to take that portion of the field that is the length of it, subtract 3 from it, or 4, technically it's subtract 3 from it, to get those last 4 characters from the end. Because you can't count from the left, like I said, because the value could be increasing in length, but you can always count from the right end of it backwards, however many characters you need to. So string manipulation is great, got a lot of cool functionality to it, and don't be afraid to combine them inside of each other. Functions can be stacked and stacked and stacked as much as you want, because all they're doing is passing a value out to the function above it. So it's embedded, if you will. So whatever's going to happen on the innermost, just like math, whatever happens on the innermost parentheses first will be evaluated, passed out to the function that's calling it. It'll be evaluated, passed out possibly to another function that's calling it, etc., etc. Something else that's really useful in Oracle is the something called, I guess we'll call it anchoring for lack of a, well, I don't know if it's an official term or not. We're going to call it anchoring for lack of a better term, excuse me. And what anchoring refers to is binding a variable data type to another variable data type. I'm calling it anchoring because it's anchors your variable to another variable already existing in the database. Why is this useful? Well, let's say that the variable that you're working with, say you're working with data from a different table, a different database, an incoming file that someone's sending you, and it has address data in it. And what you need to do is import that address data into an address table that you already have in your database. Well, you don't know the length of the data coming in. Well, I guess you can find that out easily, but it may not match the data that you already have in your table. Maybe your table is only 30 characters, or your field length is only 30 characters, but the data coming in is 40 characters. Well, what you would do is in your working storage variables there, in your local variables, you can anchor that data type. You don't hard code it and say, let's make this a varchar 2 of length 30 or length 40. Why don't you tie it to the same street length of the street field in your table? That way you know that it's always going to match. And if that ever changes, let's say down the road you decide, you know what, that table 30 is not long enough and we've been using it all this time, but let's be smart and let's change it to 40 characters. Well, all of your old programs, if you had hard-coded that value, varchar 2 of 30 in there, when you update to 40, you're not going to be filling the entire field value again. You've got 10 extra spaces that you could be using and you're not. Or vice versa, if the field is shortened and you're trying to send too much data to it, that's going to be a problem. Well, what you can do is you can cast that data type as an explicit data type and have that problem. Or you can use what's called dynamic casting to bind that to the field in whatever your application is, and that way, if it ever changes, you know that your program is going to be dynamic enough. Instead of always having a hard-coded value, it's going to go back and say, you know what, I'm going to check and see what the database wants me to use for a length. It's going to check out to see what your database is set up as, to see what that field length is, and says, oh, I'm going to use what he uses. And if that ever changes, this program will be smart enough that you'll never have to update it. You'll never have to go back and change anything. You're not going to have to go back and maintain an update. No code update needed. You don't have to go back to 500 programs and update stuff. You don't have to tell people of downtime. It's going to take us this many months or weeks or days to go back and update all these programs. Everybody's happy. There's great rejoicing in the streets and celebrations and barbecues and fireworks. Or not. I don't know. Maybe not. Might just save you time. I get carried away. What can I tell you? Well, not only can you do that for just the individual data types, but you can also do the same thing for an entire row. And if you know that you're going to be matching the entire row with all of the fields in it, instead of typing them all out individually and even individually anchoring them or dynamic casting them individually or defining them explicitly in the program, you may just want to grab the entire record set, and you can do that as well using percent row type, just as you can do percent type to do the scalar anchoring the same way. So, now let's move on to some actual program control, because this is the real reason that PLSQL exists. This is the most useful thing. All those others are little tricks and old things that you might find handy that are very common. But really what you want to use PLSQL for is for the program control, so you can write if-then-else statements. And actually there's something in Oracle called, or in PLSQL called if-then-else. There's also a clause called else-if. Now, be very careful with else-if and the spelling of it. It's a very common mistake. In PLSQL, else-if is E-L-S-I-F. It is not else space if. Very common mistake. You can get caught up with that because a lot of other programming languages use it. You can do an else clause and then have a separate if statement, but it's kind of a mistake that a lot of people make, is using else-if in the wrong way. And truthfully, yeah, you can use your if-then-else all the time, or actually just if-then is the most likely. If you're ever using else clauses, you want to be careful and think ahead to what you're doing, because you can very easily start nesting a lot of if-then-else clauses, and they can easily get deeply, deeply nested, difficult to read, difficult to follow the logic, and then very difficult to update or change later. I am finding myself with programs that are nested 20 functions or 20 clauses deep, and if I want to insert a new bit of logic, where only in this circumstance, which is 12 levels in, but not in this circumstance, which is 14 levels in, to only do this, it becomes just an absolute nightmare. So be very careful with that. There's something else that I really, really, it's kind of a pet peeve, I really wish people would use more, and that's called a case statement. Case select, a switch statement is C, call a lot of different things, but a case statement will allow you to check, instead of having a lot of nested if-thens, you can do a lot better checking with a case statement. For example, if you wanted to check somebody's gender, for example, using an if-then, you'd have to say, if gender equals M, then we'll do this. Else, if the gender is equal to female, do this. Else, if the gender is null, meaning they didn't divulge that information, or if the gender is other. You see, even just with that example, we're, what, three levels deep with an if-then-else statement? Or four levels, depending on how far you wanted to go with it. Well, we can use a case statement, and a case statement is a lot easier because it can evaluate a field once instead of multiple times, and it's much, much easier to read and debug. And the example I just gave is something called a simple case example, and basically you'll say case gender, and check it against the three values. If the value is M, then you're going to do one thing. F, do something else, null. And then you end the case. It's not nested. It's sequential. And it's all in one case, end case statement, so it's easy to follow. And you don't have to go deep. Now, you can certainly, inside of that case, do whatever logic you want. You can then put an if-then inside of that if you need to, or another case statement inside of that if you need to. So it will allow you to do that, but really, if you're evaluating multiple values to one field, use a simple case for that. And even if it's not a simple case, there's something else called a searched case, where you wanted to, say, check ranges of data. I don't know, what do we say, test scores earlier? You could use a searched case to do range of data. So anybody that gets a 90 to 100, do this. Anybody that gets an 80 to a 90 value for their test score, give them a B. Anybody that gets a 70 to an 80, give them a C, or whatever the grading scale is slid down to these days, but that's a whole nother topic altogether. You know what? It also allows you, at the very end of it, you can have an else clause at the very end of the whole thing, that if you don't meet any of those things, like let's say gender, male, female, other, at the very end of all that, let's say you had a weird value in there. Somebody put in, I don't know, W for Wookiee. I don't know, something unusual. What you can do at the very end is have an else clause at the whole end of this case that can be used for error reporting. It's that way you know very clearly, well, it didn't fall into these three criteria, so generate an error so that somebody can identify and figure out what the hell's wrong with that data and make any corrections. Else is, of course, an optional clause. It's not required on the case statement, but use it all the time to throw an exception or error messages that will help you debug your data, not so much your code. And bad data is a bigger problem than bad code in my experience. There's also something called a decode function. This is probably a little tricky to try to get out over the radio. It would be easier to see one, I guess. But basically, it's kind of like a case statement, except that it's done in stream. And you can even do it in stream right in a select statement. It is a function, just like we mentioned earlier. I can put it right in stream. And what decode does is, on the fly, it will kind of map one variable from one value to another value. So let's say you wanted to check, you had size code. Your field is size code. You could do a decode statement, pass it the field that you're going to be decoding. The first thing would be whatever the value that you're expecting, let's say 1, and then the next value is what you want it to appear, or what you want it for your whatever your program needs are, let's say small. The second thing, 2, would be medium, 3 would be large, etc., etc., and save that for whatever reason. Maybe you don't want to display the sizes to a customer or to an executive. You want to print a report that says, we have X number of small left in stock, this many large items left in stock. You wanted to print that out. Well, you can use something called a decode statement to do that on the fly. And again, it makes things look a lot nicer. Again, a lot of printouts, a lot of reports, a lot of emails. You don't want to send raw data. Raw data is ugly. Turn it into something that's nice. So you have a lot of problems with people nesting the if-thens. You can definitely clean that up by using a case statement. You can use decode if it's just something simple on the fly that you're just going to map data from one to the other. And let's see, what else? We want to talk about exceptions a little bit quickly here. I know we're running this probably the longest episode of TWA Tech ever. So I'm going to try to wrap it up here quickly. I do want to talk about one thing. It's called exceptions. Exceptions are basically error handling within Oracle. System exceptions are Oracle defined and known common areas. These are reserved words, reserved exceptions, like no data found or invalid cursor. And what these are is, if you do have a mistake in the way that you're interacting with Oracle, or some event happens, like you try to read data from a table and there's no data there, it will generate a known exception called no data found. So when I see that, I immediately know, well, wait a minute, no data found, what happened to my data? Did I delete it? Is that table gone? Did I forget to load it? Very clear and very common, so they do come with Oracle. However, you can also have user-defined exceptions, which are written custom to the application at hand. Now, how to write your own exceptions is definitely outside of the scope of this talk, but know that they exist and that you can write your own fairly easily, so that if a certain Oracle error message comes up that's very cryptic and you don't know what it is, you may walk through your code and realize what caused it. You can then create it as a named exception and use it forever so that it comes up with something that's more decipherable, and maybe even code logic around it that says, if you ever run into this, say no data found, then look into table number 2 and find your data. If there's no data found there, look in table number 3 and find your data. You can actually have it, because you're using a procedural language now, you can actually wrap that around some logic to tell it what to do in the case of certain known exceptions or known problems. So, more importantly to the tips and tricks here that we're talking about for Oracle is to talk about the scope of your exception checking or exception handling. Most people only put exception around their entire program, if they even use it at all. By devising, you can divide code up in Oracle using a begin and end statement and isolate and localize your error handling. A lot of people get in the very bad habit in Oracle of having one exception routine at the end of the program and a begin and end statement at the end around the whole program, and anything that goes wrong falls down to the one error exception. When you've got programs, and I certainly do, that are tens of thousands of lines long, then trying to isolate which one of those lines or where at in that giant program caused that becomes just mind-numbing and downright impossible at times. So what you can do is insert other begin-end markers anywhere in your code. So let's say you've isolated it down to one particular if-then statement that you've been messing with, or a case statement. Wrap a begin and end around that, and then you can write an exception check at the end of that begin-end clause and check to see, is there something in that code that caused it, or was it somewhere else? And you can move that around, you can leave that in your code to constantly check. Very, very good practice to get into handling, even if it's just temporary for testing, but very good to get in the habit of adding a lot of error checking inside of your code so that, you know, data may be fine one day, but the next day the FTP crashes halfway down, your data gets corrupted, and your program crashes, and you don't know why. If you've got some error handling in there, some exception handling, you'll be able to isolate exactly where that error occurs. When others, great, if you want to just find any unknown error, but don't depend on only that around your whole thing to find all errors. When others is a generic term to catch anything that falls out of it. And one of the more advanced topics here, and this is definitely something that would be pretty detailed and probably be better if you actually saw some examples, but just know that these exist if you ever run into the need for overloading or polymorphism, kind of interchangeable here. And what you're doing there is you're writing a package, or, well, actually this has to be an object type of package, which we haven't really talked about yet. You have stored procedures, you have functions. Well, you can also have something in Oracle called a package. And what a package is a collection of many functions and stored procedures all rolled into one object type that contains smaller objects, again, procedures and functions. And this is good for packaging up your program if you wanted to take it over to another database or somewhere else or send it to someone. Instead of having to send them 5 different stored procedures and 12 different functions, you can put them all into one package object. Don't really have to change the code at all. You just put them into one package object, and it looks locally for everything that it wants to call. Well, because of this, it gives you the potential, the possibility for something called overloading. And what that can do is you can create and have a procedure or a function in there that will allow you to send different types. Like you could say, put something called a value tester. And the first value tester function will simply take in a field, and it will check that field and return to you whether it's a character or a number. Well, if it's a number and you define it as type number, you're going to get an error message if you send a character. So you can write a second function with the exact same name that's expecting a character type. So you've got two functions that do the same thing. It's just that one accepts a number, one accepts a character. So it kind of makes it useful. You can have, that's just a very simplified example, and I don't know if it translates well over the radio, but know that you can write the same function, same name in a package to handle 20 different data types if there were such thing or some reason to do that, and we'll give you the ability to accept, and if somebody is sending you data that's numeric sometimes and character another time, write an overloaded function that'll handle it no matter what. That way, your program doesn't crash on the days that it sends you character or the days it sends you numeric and you have to change it every time. Overload it so that it'll be able to accept either type. And I guess that's really kind of going to wrap it up because we could go into some examples of polymorphism overloading, but I don't really think that it's going to translate well over the radio. So the only other thing to mention is to back everything up, obviously. Anytime you're doing inserts or updates, first back up those tables, back up that information before you start manipulating it. Put it in your own schema, put it somewhere separately where, in case something goes wrong, you can restore it. Don't rely on backups to have to restore from it or a DBA to restore from something that backup that they've done, hot backups and stuff. Put them into a schema that you're not going to confuse with anything else. I always use a date time stamp on it, and I put a clear table name like BKP backup, or even write the word out backup underscore table name underscore and the date, so that I know exactly when it was backed up, and maybe even put initials in there if it's multiple people working on it. And get in the habit of checking the counts of these tables before you get started and after you get started. Make sure that the tables have the same number of records in it when you get finished, or if you expected the table to go up in the number of records, make sure it actually did in fact go up the number of records you expected. If you're inserting 500 records, make sure that it went up by 500 and it didn't go down by 300 or something like that. So get in the habit of backing stuff up explicitly manually before you start working, so that you have something you can easily restore by yourself without telling anybody that you screwed up necessarily. Throw that data back in there, so be careful about that. And the only other thing is, I mentioned earlier something called TC, or transaction control part of SQL, and these are basically two statements, commit and rollback. And when you've done your program, or you've got your program working, it's done, or you make changes to data and you're positive that you want them to be applied to everybody in the database officially, you're going to issue a commit statement. Well, you have to go out of your way to commit your data, or you can accidentally with that DDL trick I mentioned earlier. But if you're testing and you do screw up, you do make a boo-boo, and you need to stop and start over again, issue a rollback statement. Rollback's going to help you find bugs that you may not have found at the beginning. Even if you're doing insert updates, sometimes it'll fail after processing half of your records because of an unexpected data error. Maybe they, again, put in a field that you weren't prepared to handle. They sent in the data was corrupted in the FTP and fails. Well, your program has inserted half of the data before it failed. Well, let's roll that back. Put a rollback in the end of your program, or have a rollback statement in there in your exception handling, so that if any error comes up, the first thing it should do is roll back that data, and then you can look at your program the next morning, or if they're going to call you in the middle of the night, which is very common as well, you know that, fine, the data got corrupted and it started to commit a whole bunch of them, but I, as a good programmer, put a rollback exception in there and took it all back so that no data was corrupted, nothing happened, and we'll fix it tomorrow, and everybody will be happy and dancing in the streets and barbecues and fireworks and all that kind of good stuff. So, that is going to do it. Hope you enjoyed this. I know this was a fairly long episode, but hey, this is the outlet for, sometimes they'll be short, sometimes they'll be long presentations, and this was actually an hour-long presentation that I gave to a group of programmers, so it is about an hour long as it appears now. So I hope you enjoyed that, and by all means, please keep supporting TWA Tech. Do some episodes, contact Enigma, contact somebody if you want to participate, any type of topic, presentations that you may be giving at your meetings, stuff like that. So big shouts and thanks to Enigma for keeping this thing going as long as he has, to Droops, the guys over at Infonomicon. Hope you enjoyed it, and we will see you guys next time.